if I plotted a graph of the number of commercial launches versus non-commercial launches, the commercial launches are definitely on the rise as I see it. And by the way, one other thing, getting back to Bernie's other question, and that is to detect Pluto is 40 times more difficult than detecting Earth because of the alignment probability of it casting a shadow on the sun when observed from a long distance away. So 40 times less probable are you going to find Pluto than Earth. Let me drop, but there's one other problem.
Yeah, time, I check time.
He's way ahead of me. Pluto makes one orbit in something like 240 years. You have to wait 240 years for one pass of Pluto in front of the sun. But we've still got time, Bernie. K2YO, K2LAW, for any comments?
No, we pretty well covered it. I was just pointing out that there is, if we find one, we automatically have the probability that there are 320 more or whatever that number would work out to be. And comment on Paul, I agree with Paul that I don't think ULA is considered a commercial launch. Granted, they're private companies, but it's all paid for, contracted by the military. So, but I want to see that day when U.S. companies are putting rockets up, not out of Vandenberg and not out of Canaveral. That as soon as you use Canaveral, as soon as you use Vandenberg, you're no longer a commercial. You're renting space from the government. You're getting subsidized by the government, etc. But I love watching what SpaceX is doing, and in my mind, they are the true leader in this. I'm going to need to sign clear. I'm rolling up to the house here and need to get to bed. I'll talk to you guys later. KTYO.
Bernie has to hit us before he goes in. One second.
Take your time. You got it, Bernie. I mean, you got it, Paul.
There's a place called Boca Chica in Texas, right on the Mexican border. It's in Texas. And SpaceX has been out there for years now. They're preparing the land, getting ready to build their own private launch facility. So they're going to have one, as well as a rocket lab in New Zealand. You know what I mean? There's a chance that, you know, within about three or four years, you're going to start seeing those big rockets, the same ones, Falcon 9s, launching from Texas. There you go, Bernie. WS one.
But no, absolutely. And I think that's what I'm saying is kind of the new age of space. So anyway, have a wonderful evening, guys. Great talking to you. K2YO's clear. Dick, back to you.
Very fine, Bernie. And you sound good on the input. You're putting out some nice RF. Okay, we're becoming more and more commercial. I mean, if someone had told us this, that 20 years ago, NASA's not going to be doing everything, we would never have believed it. Elon Musk, he's a very forward-thinking guy, isn't he, Paul? WS2N, K2IW.
Yeah, he's at the top of the list. There's quite a few of them now, but, Jeff Bezos not far behind, but he's catching up. Don't look in the rearview mirror, there's somebody behind you, you know, and going to be building these rockets almost as big as the Saturn V. He's got a building that he's almost got complete down in Florida, a place called they built buildings to make things down there. Expedition. Exploration Park. That's the name of it. Exploration Park. There's a series of buildings being built there, and he's one of them. And he's going to be building new rockets. It's called the New Glenn. And they'll be putting them on Launch Complex 36. Again, he's leasing from NASA. Essentially, they own it. They rebuild it to their liking. And probably by 2019, 2020, he'll be launching his own rocket with his own engines. And he's building the BE-4s. Putting them on the bottom of this monstrous rocket. So now you have the ones that are interested in tourism. You have Richard Branson, flying a spaceship too, and he'll probably be flying out of we have a private spaceport in New Mexico called, let me drop it, called Spaceport America. You know, it's really being, it's in the middle of nowhere. It's being set up for any of these companies. SpaceX is renting space there for a while. They plan on doing something, but they never did. Richard Branson with his spacecraft, they plan on putting half a dozen people in there, flying suborbital flights. They'll be there. But it did that end of it as well. Blue Origin is flying out of Texas now. Suborbital flight with the new Shepard. So a lot going on. Just wanted to go back to the planet thing. I wanted to talk about the, you can actually participate in looking for planets. You go to planethunters.org, not .com, .org. You can sign up and start looking for planets now, if you're Robert. I don't do this, but the people that they were interviewing on National Public Radio, Ira later was asking him about, you know, how could the public get involved? And he said, if you go to planethunters.org and sign up, they'll send you graphs, and you have to compare the graphs from one star to another star. Have to look for dips in the graphs, and they say computers can't do this. They need people to actually do it. The human eye picks out these patterns. You know, you might have three or four planets going around the star at one time, and it looks like it's random, but people have been picking them out, and then, you know, they send their information in, and if it's approved, they get included in the discovery of these new exoplanets. So you could actually do that. One other comment about the Alpha Centauri planet that was found. That was, you know, that is not in, you know, that's one of the closest planets to us. It's actually Proxima Centauri. That's actually not on the ecliptic as well, what I would call their ecliptic. So, you know, that was probably found with the light of the star moving back and forth. So even the James Webb Space Telescope will not be able to detect the atmosphere on that thing, because it's not in line. Back to the WS-1.
Yeah, I guess I forgot about that, but the Proxima Centauri, or Alpha Centauri, planetary discovery. And I think Alpha and Proxima, I believe it is a trinary star system. It's either binary or trinary star system, with two of the stars very close and the third one very far away. And I think the planet they found is in orbit around one of those three stars. And I guess you're saying they found it by the wobble technique, because you didn't have the proper alignment, the one chance for 320. If it's a Earth-distant planet from a sun-sized star. Along these lines, Paul, one other thing that, as I see it, we've gotten so darn much good data from Hubble. There's so darn many Hubble huggers out there. We can't possibly abandon Hubble. Even when James Webb is up, James Webb is going to favor infrared. Hubble favors a little bit of infrared, near infrared, but mostly optical and ultraviolet. Let me drop. You're going to want to continue to do both simultaneously. You're going to want Hubble and James Webb to be in simultaneous operation, as I see it. A lot of benefit in doing that. Very different kinds of spectrum, very different visibility periods, and so on. As such, you and I have discussed before that it's probably just a matter of time before somebody creates a space repair robot to send human beings up to Hubble when current techniques of getting human beings there is pretty risky. If anything goes wrong, other than sending up another spaceship to rescue them, you can't go to the International Space Station as a life raft. You just can't get there. Wrong altitude, wrong inclination of orbit. So, for there to be a repair robot that can go to Hubble, I wish they were working on creating that. I know they've made discussions of doing it, start and stop. I think there's no active project right now to build a repair mission, a repair robot satellite, or to build a space junk collecting satellite. They've had some paper designs on that, and in both cases, I think they discovered it's quite difficult. But I'd like to believe that's going to change with that new fixture they've added to Hubble. I'd like to believe that in the next 10 years or so, 5 years, somebody will say, and maybe Elon Musk is the guy to do it, it's time we create a repair robot satellite. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, they're always working on it. On the space station, they have a robot on board, on the outside of the space station, called Dexter. And they've done refueling simulations of that, unscrewing things, putting simulated fuel into a tank. It's all in the works, but the temporary administrator. There's another word for it. His name is Lightfoot. He's got his first name, but I don't know if he's going to be the regular administrator or not. Charlie Baldwin is gone. He's retired. And he was going to retire no matter who got elected. But this guy has directed NASA to include in the review of what they plan on doing in the future, looking into servicing Hubble. And I talked a little bit about that in the beginning of that. And they're thinking about using the Dream Chaser spacecraft, which is not flown yet, but it's flown in the atmosphere as a test to land on a runway. And it'll be doing more of that in the future. But by 2019, that was their first scheduled launch. They've already got a contract with NASA for 6 missions to the space station with cargo, fuel, water, spacesuits, whatever they need, let me drop it. So that vehicle has the capability of going up, launching on an Atlas V rocket, using United Launch Alliance, again, the combination of Boeing and Lockheed. They put it into a 4-meter bearing, 4-meter diameter bearing on top, and launch it to the space station. And that will happen in 2019. After spending time attached to the space station, they're going to load it up with equipment, satellite, science equipment, and send it back, and they'll be able to probably land it in Florida when they first do it. They'll probably land it on the same runway, 3-mile runway that NASA uses with the space shuttle, and they'll bring stuff back. Now, once this thing gets going, in a year or two, Sierra Nevada Corporation is developing this. Always had plans. In fact, their original plans was to have a crew on board. And what would be the feasibility and the cost of developing a system like that, where you go up and now they have that docking ring on the Hubble that they originally planned. Let's have a docking ring in some spacecraft in the future will go up there and attach itself, and we'll properly deorbit this thing so we don't kill everybody over the city. Make sure it gets deorbited over over the Pacific, instead of doing that, have the vehicle, the Dream Chaser, go up there. It has cargo bay doors. Open it up, or could dock to the or could actually dock using the rear of the vehicle. Attach to it, send out a crew, and upgrade it, service it. So they are looking into it. Whether that happens or not, they're getting the science people involved with dropping. If Defiance says that there's a demand for this, will we really need Hubble after James Webb, after TESS is up there, after WFIRST is up there? Are we going to need these things? And if the answer is yes, they'll look into it further, and maybe we'll see that somewhere down the road, probably in the early 2020s, because it will need to be serviced. Batteries aren't going to last forever. The gyros aren't going to last forever. Even the solar panels have been changed twice so far. Computer upgrades, better cameras, you name it. Back here, Dick, WS-20.
So Dream Chaser is likely to do it, if I understand you correctly, Paul, between now and 2019 when it's launched. It's quite possible it'll have the capability of doing a repair mission on Hubble. From your and my point of view, every subassembly on Hubble is repairable, replaceable. The main thing Hubble is one huge piece of glass for that main mirror, another very big piece of very specific glass for the subreflector, and all the electronics that are doing detecting. And all the electronics that does the detecting, that can be changed. The solar panels can be changed. The gyros can be changed. The main thing it is a great big frame with two huge pieces of glass. That's going to stay. And it took a lot of dollars and man hours to create those two pieces of glass in that frame and to launch it into space. So, I'm going to make a guess, Paul, that Hubble is going to outlive you and me. What do you think? WS2N, K2LIZW?
It's already outlived a lot of people that, when it was first launched in 1990, you were right about that. You were just 27 years down the road. So, yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. The trick is to get the financing for this type of thing. You pour enough money into something and you can get a lot of things that Sierra Nevada Corporation is developing this thing. They can just accelerate things. They'll have their cargo vehicle definitely by 2019, because they already have contracts for six cargo missions signed and delivered, $1.6 billion, whatever, this money is going to be transferred for these cargo missions to the space station. So now they're only a step away from, they planned originally to put a crew in this thing to send up, they also have contracts or working on possible cargo flights, a satellite flight, and maybe eventually people with Aryan Space down the European Space Agency. So I don't see that as a possibility. They have a lot of infrastructure to change down there to start flying people out of there. But they might fly, unmanned science missions out of Kourou, French Guiana, South America. In the future, they aren't talked with them, so something might eventually happen. I don't know if you've ever seen this Dream Chaser.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Very big, but you can put seven people in there. If you were going to use a crew, drop it. And you to send up the largest amount of payload, larger than what SpaceX is doing to the space station. Heavier. It also has the capability of not only berthing to the space station, but docking in either or type of situation. So they were already set up to docking with these people. So it's quite a good development. Originally, when the contract was signed with SpaceX and with Orbital ATK to send up cargo, they were left out of the loop. And then as time went on, NASA signed a deal for crew people to go up. So SpaceX got the contract for that with their SpaceX version 2, SpaceX Dragon, Dragon 2. And with Boeing developing the CRS-100 Starliner, which will carry 4 astronauts at a time. And that's going to be happening in probably within 2 years. Those two got the contract for astronauts to go up to the space station. And Sierra Nevada with Dream Chaser again was bust out. But then they said, well, you know, this space station is going on to 2024, maybe 2028. We need another contract to go out for, you know, we only originally let out 8, 10, say up to 12 contracts for cargo. Let me drop it. What they decided, you know, we need, you know, 13, 14, 18, you know, missions. So they gave out 6 more contracts to, you know, for cargo for SpaceX with Dragon, Boeing with Starliner, and then they said we need a lot more. So they signed up Sierra Nevada, was left out of this, you know, for years and years. And meanwhile, they've been developing. They've been going along developing with their own money for all these years. And they said, okay, we're going to sign on Sierra Nevada. I thought that was great. And as a vehicle, 6 flights to the International Space Station, bringing up cargo. So that's a real big boost for that company. Because you know what's going to happen. Right after that, they're going to develop this with astronauts. I know that's going to happen. Whether they fly with NASA or not. Back to you, Dick. WS1.
I heard somebody say he's got a question. It's a very noisy signal. If you do something to boost your power, go ahead. I'm going to listen on the input and see if I can hear you better. So give me your call letters, your name. Give me that much so much first and see if I'll be able to hear your question. Over to you, sir. K2RIW in the TechNet. Right now, I'm listening on the input, and I don't hear anything. The person that just called in, please give us another call, sir. K2RIW. Wonder if somebody else heard him. It was a very weak, quite noisy signal. I missed the call letters, but I did hear him say he has a question. Did anybody else hear that station? 3 transmissions ago, K2RIW.
I heard it, Dick. I did hear that, but I didn't get the call.
I wonder if he's making some kind of a change to give us more power. While we're waiting, first of all, I'm very glad that all these commercial organizations are coming along with launch capability, payload capability, astronaut launching capability. Okay, who is that station? I just barely heard Y-O-T. You've got to give us more audio. Shout into that microphone. Mr. Y-O-T, give me the full call. Go ahead.
Okay, KC2YLG,
KC2YLG. Now it sounds like, and thank goodness you talk louder, KC2 Yankee Lima Golf, is it? Yankee Lima Golf, go ahead.
That's correct, Yankee Lima Golf. My question is, how come there are no photos that any astronauts have taken from space? How come there are no photos that the Earth and the stars? Earth and the stars. How come there are no photos from astronauts in space?
Paul, I think you're going to tell us that at least one of the astronauts has taken a whole lot of photos from space. WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, oh yeah. Not only from space, but from the moon itself. He has stars up there. But I think his question is Earth and the stars at the same time. Maybe maybe that's what he means. If you're dealing with a bright Earth, it's going to be hard to see the stars behind it. But once they get into darkness, you know, the place lights up. That's how all your satellites navigate as they go through planet to planet. They all have star trackers on it. They're actually looking at the stars.
Now, the reason I think that there's going to be very few pictures of stars from space is that, astronomically speaking, a person sitting on the space station with a camera in hand taking pictures of a star, it's an exciting picture to him, but it has no scientific value. That camera taking pictures of the stars is an extremely low-resolution photograph compared to what Hubble can do. When it comes to pictures looking straight down at Earth, lots of pictures of that have been done. When it comes to taking a picture of Earth and stars simultaneously, you've got a problem. You and I see the stars very nice at nighttime. Let me drop it. At nighttime, we see the stars very nicely on a clear night because the environment we're in is very dark. The iris of our eye opens up. If you're out there for more than 20 minutes, your eye becomes dark adapted, which gives it about 20 decibels more sensitivity. You put it all together. The sensitivity of a human eye seeing a star as opposed to somebody in space looking down at the Earth, there's probably a million to one difference in brilliance. So if you try to set the camera correctly so that when you've got Earth in the picture and stars in the picture, and you set the camera correctly so that Earth is not overexposed, you will never see the stars. Set the camera correctly so you see the stars. If the Earth is in the corner of the picture, it's going to flare out and overexpose the slide. So because of the huge difference in brilliance of stars versus Earth, you can't take that picture. The people who want to believe that the Apollo mission to the moon was a hoax have specifically said, hey, we've never seen a picture of the moon, a spacecraft, an astronaut, and stars in the background. And that question has been answered many times because there's, let me pick a number, a million to one difference in brilliance. Steve in Little Falls, does that make some sense? KC2 Yankee Lima Golf. Make sure you shout into that microphone, K2RIW. Sounds like we're waiting for Steve to come back. Let me give one more listen for Steve. KC2 Yankee Lima Golf, K2RIW.
Okay, how about something like the Milky Way? Are there any photos that any astronaut has taken of the Milky Way? The Milky Way.
I don't think so. I guarantee they've taken pictures. I don't think they've been published. And the reason they haven't been published is you take a picture of the Milky Way with a camera in your hand in the space station. It has no scientific value compared to what you can get with Hubble. So it would be an exciting thing to do, but it has no scientific value. So therefore, you could say an astronaut hasn't been assigned to do it as one of his tasks. Now, there are astronauts on their free time. They use the ham radio, they take pictures of the Earth in that little cupola. There's a little blister off one side of the International Space Station that has seven beautiful pieces of glass. And let's see, what photographs, first of all, what's the name of the astronaut that has taken so many of those photographs in his free time and published them? And do you think he has taken a picture of the Milky Way? I think he has not and published it. WS2N, K2RIW.
Well, they all take pictures, but, you know, if you go out to the cupola is, like you said, seven windows that are opened up facing toward the Earth. As the space station goes around the Earth, it's always looking at the Earth. So when they're on the dark side, then they can see stars, but they're actually not looking up. They're looking down. And signs really to do that. So actually, you know, they say that the space station revolve, it actually does once every 24 hours. You know, I mean, there's so many pictures of the stars with all the, you know, regular science equipment, they really don't need that. And the dimness of certain stars are going to show up satellite, you know, like Hubble. You'll never be able to duplicate what they can see. Hubble can stay, look at one position for some minutes at a time, or even longer, like they did with their deep field search. You know, the astronauts aren't going to be able to see into the deep field. They can't stare at one location and absorb those photons like the Hubble can. By the way, that star TRAPPIST, we can't even look up in the sky in the northern hemisphere. You'd have to go just to the south of the equator and look at Aquarius. And by the way, even then you couldn't see it. It's magnitude 18. Dick, I know you know what that means. One second. If you really want to find out, Craig, let me drop it. Knows more about all the pictures that have been taken, probably worldwide, than anybody else. If you get on the Astronomy Net, first and third Tuesday of every month, and look for KQ6 Skag, he can tell you all the pictures that have been taken, Milky Way. You name it, comets, whatever's up there. Experts, super expert in telescopes and space photography. Back to you, Dick.
I'm very glad that Steve asked the question, KC2YLG. I suddenly realized I have seen a whole lot of stars from space by the NASA astronaut. You go to the right YouTube video, and there's got to be 30 of them. I've seen about 10 at least, where when the International Space Station is on the back side of the Earth, the dark side, and they're looking down at thunderstorms, they're looking at the lightning top view through the clouds using the low light camera. And as the space shuttle is continuously moving, so I said space shuttle, I meant International Space Station is continuously moving, 17,500 miles an hour, the scene is very slowly changing. And quite often the camera is aimed near the horizon because that's where the thunderstorm is. It's about to go over the horizon. In the background, you see a whole lot of stars with that low light camera slowly drifting down toward the horizon of the Earth or up. If they're aimed in the direction the spacecraft is moving, you see a whole bunch of stars rising from the horizon of the Earth. If the camera is looking in the other direction, if it's looking behind the space station, you see a whole bunch of stars sinking behind the Earth. So I've seen a whole lot of stars in space with a low-light camera when they're looking at thunderstorms top view at nighttime. You go to the right YouTube video, there's got to be 10 or 20 of those films that you can see, Steve. Wonder if that makes some sense. I'll try to find some of them for you and announce them next week. KC2, Yankee, Lima, Golf. KQRIW. You got it, Steve. I heard 1 second of Steve, and then something covered him up. He's in Little Falls, New York, so he's, let's see, from me, he's a good distance. Let's see what they say is this. He's 172 miles from me. He's down the road a piece. Thought I was hearing him in the background. One of the reports I read a month or two ago is that the first repair done by Story Musgrave gave the Hubble Space Telescope a new pair of glasses, spectacles, because the main mirror was tuned to the wrong focal length. And the focal length of that mirror was outside of the focusing range of Hubble. Because Hubble is not a simple Schmidt-Cassegrain, it's an RC, Ritchie Chrétien is the way they pronounce it. Ritchie Chrétien is a modified, higher quality version of a Schmidt-Cassegrain telescope. It's got a main mirror, a sub-reflecting mirror, and then the light is directed back down through a hole of the main mirror. But each of the mirrors, your main mirror and your sub-reflecting mirror in a Ritchie Chrétien, are slightly off of pure parabolic, intentionally, in order to get a flat field of focus. The flatness of field of the focus. They want the whole picture to be in focus, not just the center, all the way out to the edges. And a Schmidt-Cassegrain doesn't do that. A Ritchie Chrétien does. Let me drop. And so I am guessing the focal length adjustment that would have been required is that the sub-reflecting mirror must be moved further away. And that mechanism that moves the sub-reflecting mirror is limited in range. It doesn't go far enough compared to the extra focal length of the main mirror. So what they did is give it a pair of spectacles that gave it a correction. And those spectacles went down near the detector. But there's a catch. The spectacles are such that you're getting a good focus only over the center section of the main mirror. You're not getting a full focus across the whole mirror. I think Hubble is not using its whole mirror. I think it's only using some percentage of the center of the mirror. And they chose that as a repair mission because that's something that the Story Musgrave could easily do, install the spectacles, the extra set of lenses. Let me drop. If they could assign a more elaborate repair procedure, they would be able to extend the focal length of the main sub-reflecting mirror, in which case all of the mirror would be useful, and as such you're going to get twice as much resolution as you're getting right now. How much resolution, how fine a detail you can see in the sky is a function of how big is your mirror and how well it's focused. So I believe they're not using the whole mirror, because in a Ritchie Chrétien, the spectacles can't give you complete correction across the whole mirror. Only moving the main subreflector could do that. I wonder if you heard anything along these lines, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
No, I never heard that. I did hear a lot of interviews with Story Musgrave. Gave a series of interviews talking about the repairs. CoStar, they had to put in, they called it CoStar. Corrective Optic. I forget the acronym stood for. I can find that in a second on the computer, but he said that he you know, these things move that. Once it was installed, you know, this unit was installed, these things would move. There were two or three different lenses. I think, you know, they automatically move between one and another. Very sensitive. He said if he touched it with his glove as it was going in, he said the Hubble would be over. Whatever this main corrective system was, it's not looking at the whole surface of the mirror. To go up there and actually do that all again and roll the dice and have a situation like he described of, you know, touching it, he's going to ruin the whole Hubble. They gamble and do that again. I could see, you know, new batteries, new gyros, making it be better with infrared or something, or, you know, ultraviolet. To actually change that, those main lenses that he put in, I don't see them doing that.
The corrective lenses that he put in allowed you to get a good focus across, let me pick a number, half of the area of the main mirror. And those corrective lenses still can be used. But if you want to use the whole mirror, I think they've got to be able to move the sub-reflecting mirror a greater distance. However, I can see the decisions being made on this one, Paul. I'm going to make some guesses here. The degree of difficulty of getting down to the guts of the frame that holds that main sub-reflecting mirror and change it so that it can tune a greater range, and then getting that mirror reinstalled with proper alignment to get what they call columnization alignment of that sub-reflecting mirror. That's a very difficult procedure, very precise. The chances of all of that going right, just for a 2-to-1 improvement. See, what Story Musgrove did, he made an improvement of roughly 1,000-to-1 is my number. He's got 1,000 times more resolution because now it really focuses at least across half the mirror. He's got 1,000-to-1 improvement in what he did. Another 2-to-1 improvement is possible, but the risk involved is, for all we know, 50 times higher than the risk they did with CoStar. So risk-to-benefit ratio. No way in hell were they going to do that on the first repair mission. Let me drop it. I personally saw Story Musgrove, face-to-face, when he gave his lecture to the Astronomical Society of Long Island. And he gave that lecture at the Cradle of Aviation Museum. That was about 5 or 6 years ago, as I remember, maybe 8 years ago. Beautiful presentation. And he told you how close he came to losing his life during that repair mission. He pushed it to the absolute limit. He was out there longer than he's supposed to be out there. His fingers got frozen. He has no feeling in the rest of his fingers the rest of his life. Radiation-wise, he got a lifetime exposure. He took a huge risk. And on that longest space walk during that repair mission, he used up his main oxygen supply. He used up the auxiliary oxygen supply, the emergency. He was in the airlock when everything ran out, and he had to make a connection in the hose between his spacesuit and the portal inside of the airlock in order to continue breathing while they're going through the rest of the pressurization procedure. He had pushed it that far. As I said, he came awful close to dying. It was a very well-practiced mission, and he pushed it to the absolute edge. Whenever they interview, I can't think of the race car man's name right now. There's a guy who was really good at racing cars, Formula One automobiles. And various people have asked him, how in the world do you keep that mission? How do you keep that race car under control when you're going at 160 miles an hour around those turns? Let me drop it.
This is an old-timer, Mario Andretti.
Mario Andretti. He was around the same period as Mario Andretti, but it's another guy. I'll think of his name. His reply was, if that race car is in control, completely in control, I'm not racing and I'll never win. So you both keep your eyes on him.
Yeah, it was Stewart. There's a lot of guys. Fittipaldi from Brazil. You know, Emerson Fittipaldi. I'm thinking of the older guys. I don't know. I'm not sure. But they used to race the Indy cars and Formula One. So probably Grand Prix. Maybe one of the Grand Prix guys. I don't have anything else to add with the huddle, because I know that Musgrave, because of what he was doing out there, he talked about the cold fingers. They've redesigned the gloves since then. The astronauts themselves, soon the EVA can actually turn on and turn off different heaters on their fingers. So I know that won't happen on a future service mission.
Yeah, the race car driver was Jackie Stewart, who made that statement. If that car's in control, I'm not racing. He's got to push it right to the edge, right where it's just ready to break away. He's making the hardest possible turn at the highest possible velocity, just at the point where the car is about to go spin out and hit the wall. Then he's racing. And it's got to be balanced just right so that when it drifts sideways, it drifts equally. You don't want it to oversteer or understeer. You want it to drift completely sideways, if you know what I mean. It's got to be balanced just right in order to be able to get away with this crazy mission. So, Musgrave did something similar. And I'm guessing if we dig deep enough, we're going to find out that they made the decision not to try to go deep into the main frame of the Hubble, to change the design of the focusing arrangement, the focusing range of the subreflector. The main mirror was focused too long. It was ground with too long a focal length. The only way you can correct that is the subreflecting mirror has to be able to move further. And, by the way, at the same time, your detector array has to be able to move. In order to bring everything back into focus, you need a new distance for the subreflector, and you need a new distance between subreflector and the detector array. Let me drop. So with the set of spectacles they gave it, downrange, right in front of the detector, with the COSTAR, you can get a lot of correction of the error. But the correction can't correct the whole dawn surface, because the perimeter of an RC telescope has got a crazy shape to it. It's not pure parabolic. And the subreflector, the perimeter of it, is not pure hyperbolic. It's a modified parabolic main reflector. A modified hyperbolic subreflector is what I think an RC is, Retchie Kretchen. It was a very exotic catadioptic telescope design, which, when it all is singing just right, it gives you the highest possible resolution, the least amount of coma distortion, and flatness of field. It focuses all the way out to the edge of the focal plane array. Let's see you repeat all those words, Paul. I'm having fun with you. Have you heard it? Keep your eyes on it.
I'll allow the question.
Go ahead, Joe.
I've heard many things talked about with regards to life in space for the astronauts. How they eat, how they sleep, how they, use the restroom facility, so to speak. What I've never heard of, and this may sound like a stupid question, how they wash their clothes up there.
There is a YouTube video telling you the answer to that. And the answer is they do not wash clothes. One of the supplies, the consumable supplies brought up to them, is clothing. I think they came to the conclusion that an astronaut uses two sets of underwear every day, and they do not wash them. Much too difficult a procedure. You put on a new pair, and I think the old ones get thrown away. The ability to bring up new clothing, because cloth clothing is not that heavy, but the amount of resources required to wash them in weightlessness, to circulate the soap just right, and then rinse out all the soap without gravity, very difficult procedure. So I think they do not wash clothing at all, with rare exception. Even the face cloth the astronauts use, I think that is a disposable thing. I think it's a use once and throw away. That's what I remember reading, Joe. W-A-2-L-Y-Y, K-2-L-I-W.
Okay, if that's the answer to that one, then here's the next one. What are they going to do with regards to the mission to Mars? How much stuff can you possibly bring with you?
We're going to get somebody that's very optimistic to volunteer for that mission, as I see it, Joe. As you can tell, a tremendous number of these details have not been worked out. Because a human being consumes, as you've heard me say so often, the volume of your house and the mass of your house, that much food, liquid, and air goes through your body in 1 year. And that mission to Mars is a couple of year mission. Without recycling every single molecule that comes out of that human being, you don't stand a chance. And although the astronauts are doing a lot of experimentation with recycling right now, they do a certain amount of recycling of the carbon dioxide the astronauts breathe. But complete recycling, we got a long way to go. What would you find a comment on that, Joe? K2RIW.
No other comments, just curiosity, actually.
By the time you have the machinery that can completely recycle every single molecule of gas, liquid, and solid that comes out of the human being, you've got to recycle every single molecule. By the time you have machinery that can do that, I think at the same time you're going to be able to take the clothing and squirt a laser beam at them to burn off whatever's in the clothing that needs to be cleaned. And the clothing has to be carefully designed so that the laser beam has no effect on the cloth, but it has a lot of effect on all the things that are soiling the cloth. And by the way, here's another thing. Of all of the sweat, cells, and everything else that comes off your body and ends up on your clothing, every bit of that's got to be recycled on a mission to Mars. All the stuff that comes off your body and touches your clothing and stays there, that's all got to be recycled. Otherwise, you're going to run out of molecules on the way to Mars. We got 3 minutes to go, so with a brief question, give it a go, Rich. N2EO, K2RIW.
I think N2EO, not a question, a good comment. Barry told the N2MB that his son, Sammy, who lives in South Carolina, he has a degree, a PhD in genetic engineering. And he told me that, I don't know if he's still working on a project or what, but they had a project going at Clemson University where they were trying to genetically engineer plants so they could use them in clothing to spaceships.
Very nice. When you buy a bottle of Snapple drink, the cap, every one of the caps has a piece of science. And the cap that I saw most recently, cap number 1,289, says that the very first plant that was grown in space was potatoes. So, and that occurred a long time before the movie The Martian was made. And the movie The Martian, some of that was much too simplistic. That suit he was wearing while he was spending multiple days going across Mars, traveling from point A to point B in order to be launched, in order to get back home. That was much too simple. A lot of details were not properly ironed out. They didn't show you changing his diaper, if you know what I mean. Okay, we've run out of time. This was space. This was TechNet number 1640, Space Report number 240. We'll be back with a few more of these answers next week. Bye-bye for now. Over to you to tie the ribbons on it, Paul. Good material. From the OS2N, Mr. Space, K2LAW.
Okay, very good. Thank everybody that listened and everybody that participated in the night. And by the way, Voyager 2, Voyager 1, 100, almost 114 AU on Voyager 2, and 137 going on 138 on Voyager 1. They just keep on going. All right, very good. Talked about a lot of stuff. The astronauts on board, their hams, the guys that grab the spacecraft, their hams, and all the clothes, you're right, Dick, everything gets put into the old spacecraft, and they all get burnt up over the Pacific Ocean. And that's why they attach the spacecraft to the International Space Station for such a long period of time. They need to use it as a garbage disposal vehicle. 73, everybody. Back to you, Dick. WS2N will be listening out.
K2JHR, KCUPS.
Time is 12:04 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL amateur radio repeater system.
KAS to the phone radio chat.
Net tonight at 8:30 W2VL repeater system.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Net tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the W2VL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL amateur radio repeater system. Net tonight at 8:30 W2VL repeater system. Good morning. The time is 5 a.m. Net tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the W2VL repeater.
In the morning. When do you sleep?
Well, I got over 3 hours of sleep last night. No big deal.
I guess you're going to try to tell me that's enough for you.
Nah. I'm going to pick my wife up, then I'm going to head home, and then I'm going to go back to sleep. I can't go back to sleep. Then I'm going to take the kids to school. Each day they're back to school. And then I'm going to... I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm not going to get any sleep. No.
You better be very wide awake if you're driving along Peninsula Boulevard.
And I'm not driving on Peninsula Boulevard. I don't go on there anymore. I really don't. You know, I haven't had a problem since I stopped driving on Peninsula Boulevard. It's been almost a month.
No problem. Those darn red light cameras on Peninsula.